City Arts Community Conversations podcast explores the diversity of Nottingham's creative community. Series 2 shines a light on the lives and work of deaf, disabled and neurodivergent artists in Nottingham. Part of City Arts Residence Project, it's hosted by Laura Guthrie and Jay Sandu. The production is supported using public funding by the National Lottery through Arts Council England. Thank you for listening.
This episode, we're meeting two new artists. We're meeting Neil Pike, who is a poet, a playwright, and a performer. Three P's. Welcome, Neil. And we're welcome. And we're welcoming Max Markovitz, who is a BSL interpreter and a performer. And we'll find out more about Max and Neil as we chat. But welcome. It's lovely to see you both. And today we are talking kind of about the lived experience of having a visible or an invisible disability and how that kind of impacts on the work you choose to do or the way people perceive you or your work, amongst other things. But that's kind of the starting topic. So if you just want to introduce yourself and audio describe how you look today, if that's all right. And we could start with you, Neil.
Yeah, hi. I'm wearing a kind of pinky orange shirt and a pair of black jeans and green socks. And I'm feeling all right today, yeah. They're a little bit nervous of it because I've already done this for a while. It's like, you're getting to this kind of brain again.
Thank you, Neil. Max, to describe myself, I'm a white non-binary person. I'm in my mid-30s. I've got blue hair, which is long on one side and short on the other. I've got a beard. I've got purple lipstick. I'm wearing a skeleton jumper because I'm rocking the Halloween wear all year round. And I've got a bit of a chain necklace going on. Yeah, that's me. My pronouns are they and them. Thank you so much. So let's start with telling us about you and your practice. So what kind of work you create, where you create it, how you create it maybe. And let's start, Neil. Shall we start with you again?
I've always been interested in writing. But I think whether some schoolboy I've been interested in for making clothes with my head and sort of, but school, I never quite had the confidence for the right sort of ground to really let my head go loose. So I wouldn't remember why, but also I'll come back to it later. I'm a huge fan of music, so I've been inspired by sort of lyrics and kind of created really. So I've always wanted to have a go at writing, also being on stage. So fast forward to 2013, I was just struggling with life. I was not really going well in many areas. My friend Jim Hall, told me to start trying to go to a Mapped Talent session. So I was approached to a collective based at Nottingham Playhouse, run by Debree, Devlin Stevenson and Holloway. So we met every Friday and kind of gave me the confidence to start writing and began writing poetry and perform on stage. I'm going to say my practice, I think, is mainly kind of started out as poetry and then decided I wanted to write a play about school. I went to a school in Nottingham while Grant. I wanted to tell about that because it's like no one's ever really written about especially a SEN school in thought of it. Very sort of mixed my experience. It was a good bit, so I do some bit that were definitely not good.
I was just going to ask how long ago when you said you first started by going to Melody Poets. How long ago was that?
Sorry, 2013. So 9 years. So in 9 years, I've actually been quite a lot.
You really have. Thank you, Neil. So Max, tell us a bit more about you.
Yeah, so currently Primarily, I work as an access provider. I'm a BSL interpreter, audio describer, access consultant, and I also provide training on various things. But creatively, I've done various things over the years. It's quite a long and winding story. I trained as a dancer and physical theatre practitioner, and I also studied acting. I sing. I did traditional folk music primarily, and I was just starting to get paid gigs, and then I needed to use a wheelchair and I couldn't get paid gigs anymore because the venues that were small enough to pay me were also not accessible. But yeah, lots of music and stuff like that, bits of visual art. I had a piece exhibited in the New Art Exchange as part of the Queer and Trans Art Collective's inaugural exhibition, which was really cool. And yeah, currently kind of looking to getting more into performing arts again. Having done lots of access to other people's performing arts, it would be quite nice to explore that for myself again. And I'd kind of like to get into a bit of choreography, movement direction kind of stuff. Yeah, so I've got my eye on various things. I interpret a lot of drag, and I know a lot of drag artists, and I'm being persuaded by lots of people that I should really start working on my own act, so maybe that's on the cards.
Wow, a really broad breadth of work that you've done and that you're planning to do. Wow. So do you feel that, I mean, it sort of feels obvious because you've said those opportunities dried up, but do you want to tell us a little bit more about kind of how that happened? What impact did that have on you as a musician?
So with the music side of it, it was kind of very abrupt in that I'd made lots of connections locally, and I had connections in the local folk club, and I was always part of their, they used to have folk days regularly, like twice a year, and they'd invite certain guests and pay them to perform. And I was always invited to be part of that. And then I was also starting to get gigs and make connections and do open mics and stuff like that. And all the kind of basic building blocks of starting a small kind of as an independent artist. And then kind of as overnight, really, as soon as I needed to use my wheelchair all the time, once I went, I used a walking stick for a while and that was fine. I could get somebody to help me bring my guitar into the venue, no problem at all. As long as I could walk the distance, it was fine. As soon as I needed level access, I couldn't get into the venues. And so I'd get invitations, and there was a period of about 6 months where I kept getting invited to do things or invited to get to paid gigs. And then I'd have to go, is your venue accessible? Knowing full well that they weren't, and just to make sure that I had the right information, and then find out that I couldn't. So I never got the impression that anybody wasn't offering me an opportunity because I was a disabled person. It was more that the opportunities happened to be in places that were not accessible to me because of my specific access needs.
How did the people booking it respond to that?
Usually with lots of apologies. I'm really sorry, but there's one step to get in the door and the disabled toilet's down a flight of stairs, which was my funniest one. Why is your disabled toilet down a flight of stairs? Yeah, the folk club I mentioned is in a pub back room, but that's up a full flight of stairs and there's no access. And to me, the thing that is always very frustrating is that traditional folk has a target market for people who were around in the folk revival in the 70s. Who are all increasingly going to have access needs.
Yeah.
So why are so many of these events happening in inaccessible spaces? Where I used to live, there were two folk clubs that were really close to me, but one was in an upstairs room of a pub and one was in a basement of a pub. The full flight of stairs for both and no access. And so it doesn't make any sense for the art form that those events happen in inaccessible spaces, but that is the...
It's just so frustrating, isn't it? Because it's not like this isn't something that hasn't been around forever. Like people with access requirements have been around forever. And even, you know, in theatre. So the other night I went to see a piece of theatre that was by a disabled artist in a pub theatre in London. And it was totally inaccessible. I mean, it was accessible to me, but there are many, many people for whom it wasn't. And I just kept thinking, why now? Why now are we still doing this? Why is this still acceptable? I'm interested as well, Max, when you talked about now you're doing a lot more, you're doing work where you're interpreting performances a lot more. And I've seen you in performances with Grey Eye, beautifully and brilliantly interpreting as a character on stage. And obviously Grey Eye Theatre is the starting point for Grey Eye, is that the process and the performances will be accessible for everybody, both on and off stage, but that's a quite unique company. So you were saying that you're looking at, people have been saying about you performing again in drag as a drag artist and so on. Are there more opportunities now for you to physically access those spaces to be able to perform, or will that still be an issue?
I think it's still a huge issue because a lot of venues are improving their access for front of house for audiences, but they forget that sometimes disabled people have jobs and do things on stages. So there are so many venues I've worked in where I'm like, I can sit in front of the stage, but I can't get on the stage. Or if I've visited venues where I'm like, okay, so I know I can get in this venue, but actually back of house, I'm aware there isn't anything. Mm. And that's from very small scale to huge. Like I did an arena tour this year and attempting for a band, and the number of massive arenas which have terrible disabled access backstage is kind of shocking. Not shocking because I kind of expect it, but also yeah. it's shockingly bad that people still aren't aware that disabled people don't just need access front of house. We also want to work in the creative industries, and when those barriers are still there in so many places, it I think puts people off even trying a lot of the time because there are so few opportunities.
Yeah, I'd
agree. The other thing that I think happens as well is that there are some venues in town that I work with that are fully accessible, but and I don't know whether it's right. I think it's wrongfully they don't shout about it.
No.
Like they're fully accessible for artists and for audiences, but I only know that because I've booked disabled artists and I've had to ask the questions. I'm like, yeah, of course we are. There's a lift here, there's this here, there's this here, there's this yes. here. And I'm like, why is that not on the website? That's super clear.
On the quick page website then. No, you should be on the website, front page.
Yeah, and everyone should be able to see that, or there should be literally all you need is the tab that says accessibility.
Yeah.
And that's all you need. But for some reason, a lot of these venues, and I don't know why, don't make that public, and you have to talk to someone, you then have to talk to someone else, you have to talk to someone else. And then you find out that actually, yeah, they've had it all along.
I think there's an additional point there in that a lot of venues that do talk about their access, they're thinking of public audience access. So, for example, there's a venue in town which it's kind of wheelchair accessible. It's an upstairs venue, but there is a platform lift. It's not the best, but it's fine. It's a platform lift. It's just about big enough. It fits my wheelchair. I can just about manage it. It was much more difficult on a scooter because you go in through the short side and come out through the other side into a smaller room and have to then navigate your way out of it. It's a complicated thing. But at least you can get to the venue. So I've attended lots of events there. But the stage isn't accessible. And the disabled toilet is in the shop downstairs. So you have to get a member of the bar staff, if they're free, to come with you downstairs, unshutter the shop and let you into the disabled toilet, which they use for storage. So it's an accessible venue in a way, but actually
as a
performer, it wouldn't be because I can't get on the stage.
And so much of that is around people's thinking and how people perceive, like if people perceive access to be access for somebody using a wheelchair and that's it, but all that means is that there's a ramp or there's no steps. But exactly what you've just said, it's not just about, well, where's the accessible toilet, but it's also how can I get to the bar, can I be served, you know, all of those things. And also just the attitude of the staff and so on. Can I ask you, Neil, in terms to the same question that I asked Max, really, what kind of barriers do you feel are there, have been there, and what impact has that had on the work that you've done?
I think it's more the effective organisation, a lot of that kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. It more like, take me a while to like get things emailed. They've got to find the idea of emailing, get intimidating. Mm-hmm. But it's like, if you get into that mode, which doesn't happen very much for me, where I can maybe write 20 emails in half an hour. Mm-hmm. But then it's just some days or weeks and months where you're like, I think the bad for me is that, with general organisation and kind of just struggling to, like, I know what I want to do, just figuring out how to do it.
Yeah. Oh, how have you addressed those barriers? So in order, because you've been a very successful artist, you've created one show that you've toured, And when you've been on tour with that show, there's an element of organisation and admin that has to go with being a performing artist on tour. What kind of things have you put in place?
You'll get a team or even or a person that I come to well, do you kind of wait for you? Yeah, the admin, we would do all kind of. So, not to come with me, great partner is people come at me, who direct for show. And they were also with the they also if they take most of my had producer Matt used to do a chip page, but I did bit, but if I get a bit fluffed in it, we used to send it to Matt and Matt used to do it for me. So I think you turn on the kind of favorite artist, you've been quite hard to do everything on your own. Which I've tried to become quite independent when it's like I've been feeling like, yeah, this is not gonna work. It's a bit snowed under, so I kind of have been, you've got a hat to support or someone who's can kind of does that stuff. But I think it more that it does take away my brain power from that creativity side as well. So trying to balance to do everything, it can get a bit exhausting. We've got the same time.
Just to add about visibly and invisibly disabled, I have a very obvious physical access need in that I will arrive sitting in my wheelchair and it's very obvious to people, or I'll tell people in advance I need wheelchair access. But I'm also an autistic person and I have access requirements regarding that. But that often gets a bit forgotten about because people are so flustered worrying about physical access that they then, when I go, actually, I need my interview questions in advance like I had for today, which is great. So I had time to prepare. And so that helped me manage my anxiety and I've had to think about what I was going to say, what I would talk about today, just as one example. But there might be things in a space that I find inaccessible or that I find difficult, and like food is quite a difficult thing for me. So often when I'm doing contract negotiations, I'll have a bit of a chat with somebody about my needs around that. But that often throws people because they're so busy going, oh, but visible access needs. You already have all of these things. You can't also have all of these things. But weirdly, that's not how it works.
Max, I was going to say, like, I've never even thought about the difference between a wheelchair and a scooter until you mentioned it earlier. It's the first time that I've ever thought, just because it's accessible for one of them doesn't mean it's accessible for another. And I've put gigs on and made sure that it's accessible for things, but I've never thought about it from both, because they're completely different devices, aren't they, and everything.
They drive differently, the different weights, the way they maneuver is different. Even within just wheelchairs, the way a manual wheelchair works is very different from the way a power wheelchair works. And power chairs come in lots of different shapes and sizes. Turning circles change where your turning radius is. So whether you're like driving from your back wheels or whether you've got a center turning circle. Yeah, there's a huge variety. And the thing that actually is, you know, with my current wheelchair, there's quite a lot of platform lifts that are too small. So if they're like fold down ones, it was something that came up a lot when I was touring with the Grey Eye show, that they had to check in all the venues that if the lift that was to access the stage was one that folds down, they had to measure it and make sure that I could actually fit. Okay. My favorite example of bad access was at a hotel in London. We're there for the premiere at the South Bank Centre, big, glitzy, glamorous. I arrive at my budget hotel and the accessible room on the ground floor is actually up 6 steps. And to get to that room, you have to get a member of staff with a key to turn on the platform lift, which folds down, which I couldn't use because it was too short for my wheelchair. So then they had to put me on a different floor in a different accessible room, which had a bathroom I couldn't use because I can't use a lowered bath. I have to use a wet room shower. And that was a welcome to the glitzy premiere weekend that you've got going on.
I was literally just about to ask, like, have you been somewhere that said they're accessible and then you've got there and they're just, they're not set up for your accessibility, even though you've told them prior.
Yeah, and it can be in lots of different ways. So sometimes it's that they say they're accessible and they're actually not for a lot of people. And sometimes it's they think that they're accessible, but actually they've only thought about a very narrow selection of things. And when I do access consultancy, obviously part of my job is to go, so this might be accessible for XYZ reasons, but it's not accessible for these other all of these other things, and to kind of spot those bits. But yeah, it's a thing that's, I think, lacking that knowledge. And I can understand why, because venues don't have an access manager as standard. That's not something that people have access to. But I strongly advocate for bringing expertise in when you need it. And actually, it's a thing that's, I think, missing from a lot of performing arts venues. Is that kind of breadth of knowledge. And if it's not in-house, then, you know, bring somebody in to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
Can I ask another question of both of you, really, which is about the work that you do? And I know that it's different for both of you because your approach to performance or making art is, they're different genres and so on. But how much of yourself as a disabled person and your lived experience as a disabled person, how much of that is in your work?
It's a hard one to answer, really, because a visual arts piece that I made was about specifically the intersection of being a trans person and a disabled person and being hyper-visible and also invisible kind of simultaneously, because people see the wheelchair but they don't see anything else, or they only see that I've got a beard and that doesn't fit in with what they think I should look like, and that's this weird thing. So yeah, but it's this, yeah, that was all my whole thing was kind of about that. So that was a very personal piece. I think as a broader thing, I'm kind of open to trying both. I think I'd also quite like to answer Jay's question, just because it's accidentally hit upon an interesting thing. I still feel like I can't write, and I know the roots of it now, and I didn't get my autism diagnosis until I was 30, and that kind of gave me permission to kind of look back at my whole life and go, oh, that thing that I've always found really difficult, I always thought I knew why, I now for sure know why that was difficult. And in school, in the literacy hour, we were all given a blank sheet of paper and told to do some creative writing, and I would sit and have a panic attack and a cry for an hour and not write anything, because that wasn't enough information to go on. And yeah, even if someone did try and support me, because I was, in quotes, an academic high achiever, people didn't really feel like they needed to support me academically, because I was getting the good grades and I was doing everything right in that sense. It didn't matter if I was falling apart because emotionally it was very difficult, or it was very difficult in terms of anxiety, because I was getting the grades that they needed, and that meant end of story. So I didn't get that support that I actually needed. And yeah, so even if somebody did try and kind of intervene, it would be, well, you like dancing, why don't you write a story about ballet? And I'd go, okay, but what about, and what's the structure of it, and how long should it be?
Yeah.
And does it need to be perfect? And I have a million questions, but at the time I didn't know, I didn't have the vocabulary to express any of that. But that has manifested as now, if I have to write anything creative, I immediately go straight back to that place of, I just want to cry. Yeah. There was a moment where, as a creative exercise, partly to feed into our audio descriptions for the Grey Eye show that I was in, we were asked to write a haiku about ourselves, and I cried for 3 hours about that, which I know is ridiculous. And and in the end, I just wrote in kind of 5 minutes, and I was like, right, I'm just going to go with a list of words, and I'm going to take the pressure off myself. I'm going to go, right, describe me, just list things, make it fit the right syllables, that will do. And most of that ended up in the audio description of the show, because it was fine. But that level of panic is specifically there because education taught me that I can't write, even though I actually can and always have been able to. But it's meant that I've shied away from it specifically, you know, because I was, the environment was not an inclusive one.
I was going to say, Max, that's a really similar thing to me, that I got told I was dyslexic after I'd left uni and done my teacher training and everything like that. I just wondered why all my assignments were terrible and just had sentences that weren't even English in them. And then I got told I got ADHD when I was 30. Said, yeah, similar to you. And then in that moment, because I was a secondary teacher by trade for a long time, and I've sent so many kids through to be diagnosed and got all of them correct. And then when I got told I had it, I was like, oh, right, that makes sense.
The reason I'm an expert on this thing.
Yeah.
I'm happy other people struggle that I'm having myself.
Yeah. And it's mad because I didn't do anything creative. I loved writing creatively at primary school, but then when I went to secondary school, I felt like it got beaten out of me, even though I absolutely loved it. Didn't touch anything creative till I was 29, nearly 30. And then it's now my full-time job. And I have sat there and thought, if I wasn't the top in the school at maths, would I have had the support? Would they have picked up these things earlier? And then would I have been creating for a living from 21, opposed to, would I have picked a different uni course? I did accounting and finance. The maths side of it, loved it. Or the writing side of it, hated the entire thing of it. And I sit there and think, could my life have been completely different if someone had just went, oh, Jay, you can't read and write properly, instead of putting you in top set English and forcing you to do what everyone else is doing, we're actually going to support you. Yeah, it was really interesting to hear you say that, because it just, everything just struck the exact same notes that mine has.
And it's had such a knock-on effect in other creative practices, because not only have I never explored writing, and I kind of don't think it's ever going to be something that I could do, just because it makes me so anxious even thinking about doing a creative writing assignment. I'm immediately back sitting staring at a white blank sheet of paper having a panic. But improvisation in any context has the same kind of effect. I'm fine if it's music, if it's movement based with music, I've got enough stimulus for that not to feel so scary. But when I was studying physical theatre, we'd have one afternoon a week where they'd do, this is your chance to improvise. Have an empty black box theatre. We're going to put you in a spotlight and you're going to just improvise in front of everybody. And I would never volunteer, but when they forced me to, I literally would just stand there and cry because it has the same effect. I'm immediately going, I need more information. I need some kind of guidance as to what to do. Click into the headspace of I can now create something.
And I think that's about those barriers, isn't it? It's about people as disabled people with invisible disabilities, particularly neurodivergent diagnoses. It's when we talk about physical structures that are in place, ramps, etc., lifts that are a flexible size, signage and so on, they're really obvious to people. But the things that, but if you think about the processes and structuring processes so that they become accessible, then that's a whole area that people just people are starting to get it, but it's just not there, is it? So when you're talking about I need support with admin and organization, that's about that blank sheet of paper again, isn't it? It's like, okay, so I know I've got to get this idea that I've got in my head in a format that an artistic director is going to understand enough for them to get excited about it. But how do I get from in my head into the format that's going to be seen by the people who can program my work or even support my work? And having people working with you who get the structures that you need in place is just so important, because if any of that changes or isn't there, you're back to square one again, or you're back to that space where all you can do is cry or freeze, or your self-determination and self-esteem just goes out the window. And what you know intrinsically you can do, which is create a piece of theatre, create a piece of music, create a piece of visual art, create a stand-up routine, whatever. Intrinsically, you know you can do that. But without those structures in place, you're frozen. You can't actually get anywhere. It's so important that people understand that as disabled people, access needs are not just about the physical, obvious physical things. It's also those processes and structures that are really important. And it's going to be different for different people. So what, Neil, you find useful to help you create a piece of work is going to be different to perhaps what you find, you know, and Jay and me.
When you do everything Matt said about empty black box studio life, and I'm like, that sounds like my name heaven.
Yeah,
it's funny. I think for me, I think the fear is starting something.
Yeah.
So kind of similar thing, where once I've started, it's fine, but kind of like, so I think for me, improvisation helps, because then you don't have to think. You take your thinking away.
So when you're a viewer or you're an audience, do you seek out work by people that you recognise yourself in? Or is that something that you, I don't mean only see that out, but is that something you would do? Would you look for work by people that you could recognise yourself in?
Yeah, because the fact that I've never found it question the most difficult. Because most of the work I find inspiration from mainly by the people that are there, everybody. Yeah. So I find that interesting, because in time I've actually, you know, kind of people know what influences, I don't know, maybe there's, they've actually a couple where actually, well, one because they've I do rally for years, but there's kind of a poet, rapper, podcaster, and then go actor can still be fit. I didn't realise a few years ago you have incredibly severe stutter. Mm-hmm. And it's like it's really bad. Mm-hmm. But you know, until they were podcast, but for that kind of
But you were a fan of Scroobius Pitt before you knew that.
Yeah, so that's kind of it. So kind of more, yeah, because it started out as a post I'm a poet, then kind of went into rapping with and then it kind of moved in a podcast and acting. So it kind of let the music poetry let that scene. It's like, but it's still like somewhat of kind of felt a bit of connection to it because it was doing it on stage. You just kind of, yeah, also, yeah, that's only what I can say. Ring of that, I have lots of influences, but all influences more like people that are definitely far and out of it. Yeah, but one, if it'd be weird, yeah, but Pip's only one I can think of, yeah.
And of the non-disabled artists that you've had inspiration from or that you really enjoy or impacts on your work, who else is there?
Yeah, the same. Obviously, I think I kind of pick and choose it because what kind of the poetry scene, it kind of Caroline Baird and Roger Robinson. Because one, because Caroline Baird's quite surreal, and Roger's kind of, Roger's the ethos is kind of like, so to my mind, just do it.
Mm.
Kind of just like, you can get also, so I think, I was taking place from artists, fearless, so I can give a massive music fan to a big influence, maybe not on what made, but also I feel that they are completely too fearless, is one of ready with. And another is, I need to listen to the album more this year, with Kendrick Lamar. But because of someone who's just like, I'm going to do this, if it takes me years to do it, right, fine, I'm doing it. Yeah.
That's interesting, the idea that it's the type, it's that description of people as fearless, they're the people that, that attracts you to their work. Yeah, it's interesting. Max, how about you? What artists do you know, what draws you to artists?
I think as a consumer of arts, as opposed to a creator of arts, a huge diversity really is the thing. And I find that whatever art form I'm watching, there will be some element of it that I'll go, oh, I love that bit. And that might not be the bit that I'm meant to be focusing on. It might be that I love the lighting in this. Leave the theatre, I'm there to watch the theatre, and the theatre's great, but actually I'm going, oh, I love that lighting, the way that they use that, and that was brilliant. And those are the bits that I find quite creatively inspirational. And in terms of like people who are maybe similar to me or under the same kind of general umbrella areas of me, so other queer people, other trans people, or other disabled artists, I do definitely seek out work by those people, and whether it's about that topic or not, there's something special, I think, in just knowing that I've got something in common with the person who created this. And it might be terrible and I might hate it. So it's not like I will necessarily love every piece of work by every person I share any kind of characteristic with. But often I find that there's so much lived experience that is shared in certain marginalized communities that actually you find a lot of common threads that really resonate with you in people's work. And I didn't really plan to name drop, but Jamie Hale is definitely a huge one. I interpreted their show recently, which is, it's entirely focused, it's called Not Dying, and it's focused on being a disabled person and having high care needs and having other people decide what you are and are not allowed in terms of your care package. And it's about much more than that. It's a brilliant show, and I would recommend seeing it if that's possible for you. But yeah, it's just great. It's very intense, and it kind of pushes people's awareness of, oh, actually, yeah, if you take away somebody's 24-hour care package, they can't work anymore, and they might, that they're also at risk of losing their health and going back into hospital, and there's all these things that are not decided by the person themselves. And so the whole piece was brilliant, and I loved interpreting it, and I loved working on it, I loved watching it start to finish. Excellent. But also, we're both trans people. And there was a section where they had like a acted Zoom call, which was a group of professionals discussing the care plan for the character in the show, and they keep misgendering and getting the pronouns wrong. And there was the kind of hum in the audience when that was happening was really kind of satisfying, because this shared experience, we're all going, yep, we've been in those meetings, we've had those meetings done about us, we've received the letters which have three different sets of pronouns in them because people don't know what they're doing. And even though it's been very clear from the start, like my care plan from my care and support plan from the council for my carers at home has three different sets of pronouns in it, and I've told them to change that so many times, and they keep going, okay, but it still says I use a mobility scooter, which was in 2014. Could you maybe update it, because it's really incorrect information, and I actually need my care and support plan sometimes for evidence for for things, and it'd be quite nice to have one that doesn't have he, him, and she, her in it, because I don't use either of those pronouns. Mm. So can we not? So yeah, Jamie Hill's work really resonated on so many different levels. So it was brilliant to be part of that. And I know they also were very pleased that I was the interpreter for that, because we have that shared lived experience. So I could connect with the work in a way that somebody who didn't have that lived experience. I've gone off on a bit of a tangent, but
no, that's really interesting. Definitely. Well, we've come to nearly the end. Is there anything, Jay, that you still want to ask, or anything that Neil or Max you wanted to tell us while you were here, or that's come up?
I feel like I remember a few years ago, and now I'm about to wave, but the word brave, I remember a few years ago, and now, the word brave, I mean, the word brave, 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 the word brave
Bannum.
Hold on.
But that.
Yeah, I'm down for that. Yeah. Well, I think
we're
on that note.
Very brave for having that, for having this chat today. So brave. It's been such an inspiring.
And I think on that note, we'd like to say thank you to everyone that is in this podcast and everyone that is listening at home. And there's going to be information where you can find both of these guys, where they're performing, their Instagrams, there, where to find out more information about them, in the description. You're going to see all of that. So click around and enjoy.